This is the Empower Podcast, released November 28th, 2021. Episode 568, sponsored by Mouser Electronics. YouTube to Consulting with Florin of Voltlog. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
My name is Florin, but most people know me as Voltlog from the Voltlog YouTube channel.
Hey, Florin, how are you?
I'm doing good. And how are you, Chris?
Good. I find that I increasingly have stuff, I point to stuff on my bench and people are like, oh, where'd you find out about that? I was like, well, Voltlog made videos about this. Your YouTube channel and your videos, increasingly you find stuff that I'm like, oh yeah, that's got to be on my bench. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. I like doing that stuff. And I think that's probably one of the main reason that people follow my channel, because I discover interesting stuff that they can learn about it and then later on use it for something.
That's right. Yeah, I think the things that the main one on my bench is the long throw microscope. It's really, it's like a webcam almost, but super useful for basically monocular, not binocular, but monocular vision. And then I put it to a small monitor on my bench. You actually put that into a trinocular setup,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
on your bench.
That's a great thing though, because you can use it in different setups. Like you have the monocular and you have it at a higher distance up your workbench, because I've seen a picture of your setup and that worked great for you. For me, it works better on a trinocular microscope. So that's great, because we have the flexibility for that kind of camera.
Yeah. It also seems like you kind of find stuff that's like lower cost, usually like AliExpress, Banggood, things like that. And that's always useful too, just because it's a lower risk. It's not necessarily the cheap, it's not like $10, but it's like, you know, maybe $100 for a microscope versus, you know, looking at something like Dave has, like a Mantis. I'm like, oh, yeah. I'm not paying $3,000 just to try it out, you know? So yeah. that's a tough sell.
Anyone would love to have a Mantis, but not anyone gets one.
Yeah, that's right.
and so we need the alternatives. Like most people need the alternatives.
I have a running eBay search, and there's like some album, there's like some like CD or album from the 70s that has Mantis in the name. And so like every, like probably like twice a week, I get this thing that's like, ooh, new Mantis listing. I'm like, oh, the CD again.
Oh my God. That happens to me as well for various searches.
Yeah. It's you gotta be real specific, but sometimes it's good to have like just the really broad search and do the human filtering, just cause you might get someone who like labels it wrong or whatever. It's just, you have to put the work
in,
you know?
And for that reason, you could get like a really low price for a specific item, which would otherwise sell for a lot more.
That's right. Yeah. I used to play drums, and I think I mentioned this on the show before, but I used to have running searches on Craigslist, which is like a classified listing in the US. And I would always spell cymbals wrong. So instead of like cymbals, C-Y-M-B-A-L-S, I would do like S-Y-M-B-O-L-S and like just get people who are terrible at spelling and try and get some cheap equipment off people who can't spell.
That's really clever, man. I never thought about doing that.
Yeah. It's a little more helpful when it's like, you know, really available stuff, you know, like a Mantis scope or microscope is going to be a lot more rare, it feels like.
Yeah.
So you're usually buying this stuff from like a AliExpress or Banggood or stuff, but you are shipping it to Romania where you live. What's it like in Romania? What's the electronics scene like? What's it like getting stuff imported from China equivalent? What's that like?
So I would treat these as two separate subjects. So one of them, importing stuff into Romania, is not as easy as one would think of, like when you compare the experience that you have in other European countries or even with importing stuff into the US. So first of all, when you import something from outside the European Union into a European Union country, you will have to pay VAT on that.
Yeah.
And recently they changed the rule on that, because previously there used to be this rule that anything under 10 or 15 euros wasn't really supposed to be charged. So a lot of these small packages used to go through without being charged VAT. Mm-hmm. But recently they changed that. So now it doesn't matter which value your package has. It has to be charged with VAT. And because of that, various postal services also started charging this handling fee because they are now collecting that VAT for the government.
Yeah. And just for people that are US-centric, VAT is value-added tax. Is that right?
Yeah, that's just a tax that gets added to every product, every purchase.
Yeah. Well, you operate as a business now. Are you allowed to do like the pass-through thing? And
it depends. Like, it depends on what, because you could be registered with different types of handling of VAT. So the most common way is that you still pay VAT, so there's no. But once you reach, once you go past a certain threshold in your business, you are obligated to switch to collecting and dealing with VAT.
Got it. Got it. Yeah. That's, I mean, the handling charge too, that, I mean, someone made a video about this. I think it might've been you, but it was basically like a lot of the low cost packets. So like something where you might get like a $5 supply in eBay, like a power supply. It's like that becomes, that doubles the price and becomes a hassle now.
Yeah. Just because of the handling charge, which is a fixed rate. And sometimes that's higher than the actual VAT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
But then you have also a number of other limitations that might happen for various products. I don't know, some types of products have these additional tax, additional import tax on top of VAT, but it depends on the category that that product falls in.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't remember any specific examples right now, but in often cases you are charged with an additional import tax.
Got it. All right, so more of a hassle than it used to be, which sucks. But
yeah, and it's also not just about collecting these taxes. It's also about how slow the process is. Because yeah, a lot of, at least here in Romania, a lot of this stuff doesn't happen automatically. So I would be happy if the package was delivered next day with an invoice, and I would just have to pay that invoice.
Yep.
But a lot of the times, it's not like that. It's a hassle. It's a lot of emails have to be sent. A lot of documentation needs to be supplied to the like customs authority, and that just takes times and add delays when you're like doing consulting for a client and you have to build a board and you have to build some prototypes. You have to explain to that client that there's a 1 week delay because some authority in your country needs to process that import until you get it.
Right. I'm walking him through what a capacitor is and an inductor and why I had to buy these things.
Stuff like that.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So that definitely adds a layer of, you know, complexity and delay to every import I have to do.
Yeah.
But there are also, you know, good stories. Like, for example, Mauser has this system where they collect all of the tax and they file all of the documentation required on their end.
Oh, really? Oh.
So, yeah, I could have like a Mauser order placed Friday evening and have it delivered Monday morning. And that's like 6,000 miles away from me. That's impressive.
Cool. Yeah.
And that's totally because they handle this on like a higher level. It doesn't have to go through the local authorities here anymore.
That's nice. Yeah. That's great. So then you also said there was like a two-parter there as well.
Yeah.
So then what is Romania like? So is there an electronics scene that locally, stuff like that? How did you get into electronics?
It's a funny story, actually, how I got into electronics. Like, I don't know how it used to be in the US, but here when I was a little child, you know, the old cars used to have very basic electronics in them, but still, they have a couple of blinking LEDs or stuff like that. And I was always curious, you know, when I saw those things, and I always wanted to understand how that works. And I wanted to be able to build my own circuit. So I started as a very young kid, you know, tinkering with electronics.
Usually the next line in the story is, then I started taking things apart. I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried for the adults in your life at this time. They walk out to their car being disassembled.
Yeah. I mean, I did it all. Like my parents are keep telling stories. Like, I used to plug things into the wall sockets and I used to get shot early on.
Yeah.
And I did all of that as early as possible. but then, you know, so I started getting some electronics books. Some of the stuff in there was very hard to understand. And I realized I need to follow some kind of, you know, school education that would help me understand what they're saying in these books, so I can understand those circuits and actually build them and modify them. So then, you know, the obvious followed. I studied, I got my bachelor's degree, and from then I started doing all sorts of projects and even consulting. Like, I'm pretty happy to and lucky to be able to say that, for example, during my bachelor degree, I was able to design this development board based on a microcontroller and actually sell it to the school where I was studying at.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, so not a lot of people get a chance to do something like that. So I was pretty lucky to be able to do that.
And what was on that board?
So the issue was that we had these microcontroller classes in school, but we studied a lot of theoretical stuff. Like, we wanted to be able to test the programs that we were thinking about, the algorithms that we were implementing. And, you know, we wanted to see how coding for these registers inside the microcontrollers would actually behave on real hardware. And we were missing that in class. So I just built a board that used a PIC32 microcontroller and had lots of peripherals on board. Peripherals that are typically fun to play with, like sensors, temperature sensors, accelerometer, you know, an LCD, a serial interface, stuff like that. It would be fun for someone to write code and actually see something happening with that board.
Right. And I think you also remove a lot of the jumper wire aspect that a lot of school programs do, which is, you know, it has value in its own way. But if you're focusing more on the code than the, you know, what hooks to what, then that can really help to move things along and let people go a little deeper on the code side.
Yeah, certainly. But then to answer your other question, what is the electronic scene here in Romania? It's not as good as I would like it to be. I know, for example, that if you want to work in this field, there are a few companies, mainly in the automotive space, that hire people to build electronics. But other than that, I don't think that there is a lot of electronics industry here in Romania. And it was the obvious choice for these big automotive companies like Continental and others to open up shop here in Romania, because there are a lot of talented young people, and it's probably cheaper for them to hire talent here than it is in the west of Europe. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I don't think we have an electronic scene here in Romania. So that's why a lot of my activity is in the like online playground.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's great. And it opens it all up so that you can be in the marketplace and offer your services and obviously make great videos. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I, you know, like, I remember Hungary has a decent amount, which is east of Romania. Looking at just like other countries in the area, Poland has, you know, we've had Ant Micro on. They're up, I forget where they are, Poznan maybe, but they're up in Poland. So like, kind of like, obviously Eastern Europe and stuff like that in general has some electronics, but it seems it's a large area, of course. You know, it almost seems equivalent to the US and like spreading across the Midwest. There's like pockets of electronics in different areas. But if you're not in that specific pocket, it's like, okay, well, what is this really going to do for me?
Yeah, exactly. And in the actual city where I live is Constanza, which is near the seaside, it lacks even more in the electronics industry. Mm. So I had the choice of either do something in the online space or relocate. And I really like the place where I live. I wouldn't want to move unless it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah. I mean, living by the seaside is pretty nice.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, Black Sea. That's cool. That's really cool. I'll have to look at some photos later. That seems like there's like one really interesting looking old building right on the seaside in the Google images. I'm not sure what that is. It looks like
it's the 1800s. Casino, maybe. It's called Casino. Yeah that's actually renovating right now.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, that's great. All right, I'll add it to the list. Got other places I got to visit. You know? That's great.
Actually, Andreas Peace, you know him. You've had him as a guest on the Empower. He was here. He visited and he liked it very much.
Oh, awesome. You guys get to hang out?
Yeah. It was pretty cool to hang out with the Andreas Peace, the legend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Swiss YouTuber. Yeah. so let's talk about some of the videos you've been doing. So you mentioned the automotive industry, and I have noticed you've done quite a few videos are on like interfacing to a car, things like that.
Yeah.
You just did a recent one about ESP32 and controlling a car over CAN bus. What's your general interest in automotive?
So this topic kind of opened up to me when I was in France in 2011, 2012. I was there to get my master's degree. And as part of that study program, we had to do an internship with a company in the field of electronics. And at that point, I went with Freescale, and I was assigned to their analog and mixed signal and power division. And they generally deal with automotive in that Freescale division.
I was going to say, we should say Freescale, rest in peace, now NXP.
Yeah, now NXP.
Yeah.
Yeah. And during my internship at Freescale, I got to work at this really cool IC that they were developing.
Uh-huh.
It was supposed to be the next generation engine control unit. So like the CPU inside an engine control unit. And as you know, across all industries, everyone tries to, you know, increase their profit margin. And to do that for an engine control unit, you basically need to integrate as much as possible into a chip and avoid populating that stuff as external on a PCB.
Right. Which these days would probably make you seem, assuming you could get the ECU chip, it would make you seem very smart because you wouldn't have all of the other chips that you would need to buy and couldn't get in the automotive space.
Yeah. That would probably be a good idea these days. Yeah. So that was like my first incursion into like the automotive electronic side of things. Mm. And I really liked it. I mean, there was so much stuff that I didn't know it worked the way it did. And
any examples of that?
Like this stuff that I worked on, this chip, like they integrated so much stuff inside a chip, like both analog and digital. Like they used to need all kinds of these external filters, like no more. Mm-hmm. We'll put them all inside the chip. And on top of that, we'll put multiple values and we'll add this like selection matrix, and you can control and enable all of those filters digitally. And all of a sudden you have all of these new capabilities that enable so much more for that ECU.
Got it. And I mean, when you're looking at an ECU as well, like I guess my inclination is to think that it's just kind of like maybe a CAN bus or two and a LIN bus or two, and then that's the main interface to it. But it seems like you're talking more like GPIO and like direct interfacing there.
Yeah, I guess that can vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, but the ones I've seen, like they have like a bunch of sensors that tie in directly to the ECU, because the ECU is the one taking decisions on how to run the engine, and running an engine is based on a lot of sensor data, sensors that are spread around the engine.
I see. So it would be too much overhead time to have it go through a secondary processing, or you wouldn't want to have it on a bus where it might be time multiplexing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I would guess so. Like many important sensors tie in directly to the ECU box.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, and I guess the other thing too is that like I get a little confused about the term ECU, because I thought that other processors in cars are sometimes called ECUs, even though they're not directly controlling the ECU or the engine. Is that correct or incorrect?
From my side of things, the way I see things and the people I've worked with, we were only calling ECU like the control that deals with the engine.
Got it. Okay. All right. So then that makes more sense then too. I mean, so then what is the relative spec? I mean, obviously this is 2011, 2012, you said. So like, but what is the relative spec of a processor in that space? Is it like a Cortex M0, Cortex M4, Cortex A something?
I can tell that it was all custom. Like,
oh, interesting. Okay.
It was all custom. And I can tell you that due to wanting to get the most out of it, it was all coded in assembly. So it was running assembly code.
Wow. Okay.
But it doesn't have to do like very complicated stuff. It just needs to take very fast decisions based on, you know, sensor data.
Got it. So like pipelining, you know, if this sensor goes up, then do this other action on the other side on a GPIO or something like that.
Yeah. And at the same time, control like these high current outputs that sometimes drive, you know, the injectors that inject fuel into the engine. At the same time, all of this operation needs to happen over a very wide range of temperatures and like supply voltages, which complicates things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, we were talking about how this opened up my interest for the automotive electronics, and you can kind of see how there's all sorts of complicated and interesting stuff happening in the automotive electronics, and I like it. And so I kind of continued after that and started thinking about these small projects that I could design in my lab and play with automotive electronics. And one of them is the CAN light. And this is a board that I designed, probably started designing that a year ago. And what I wanted to do is to kind of interface with some of the electronics on board of my car. So I wanted to kind of read some information from the CAN bus and maybe put something on the CAN bus that would trigger a reaction in the system. Mm-hmm. So I made this board, which has an ESP32 on board. That is the processor of the board. Then I have a CAN transceiver for interfacing with the CAN network. The ESP32 does have a CAN interface, but it needs an external transceiver to, you know, switch the lines at the correct voltages. Mm-hmm. And I also added a couple of automotive high side switches to this board. Now, automotive high side switches are like, you know, a MOSFET, just that it has some added intelligence. It has some added protection features. So you deal with it approximately the same way. You just switch a logic high or low to control it, but it does its own thing to protect it against transients, to protect it from over temperature, over current situations. And that's really nice to have, because from this little board, I can then turn on or off a small motor. I can control something on power to something that is hooked up to my car. I wanted to say that it also contains an automotive grade DC to DC converter for power, because, you know, you can't just go and use any DC to DC converter on one of these boards, because what might happen is there are a lot of transients on the like 12 volt line on a typical car. So there is a high chance that a typical converter might fail at some point due to all of the stress that it encounters.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, it is a rough environment. And the ESP32, what is that rated for in terms of temperature? Like, could you actually put this whole unit into a, you know, automotive rated environment? No, or is it more, I mean, like zero?
It's more like standard. It's more like standard temperature range. So you wouldn't expect it to kind of work at those extreme temperatures. But then again, if it sits on the inside of the car, it's probably not subjected to those.
Right.
Most of the times it will not be subjected to those extreme temperatures.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and this seems like this is a great way for people to kind of start tinkering with their car, maybe not make a product out of it, but then they, you know, they could get a better feel for what's going on and then harden it over time and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think it's an awesome little CAN hacking platform, because
otherwise,
what are you going to do? Are you going to grab like one of these big STM32 development boards? Right. And that's going to take up a lot of space, and it's going to make your life harder if you just need a CAN interface and a beefy processor to run your code.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So obviously you talk to your users, the people that are buying these boards. What are they doing with it?
So they're doing lots of interesting stuff. Like, one of the users emailed me some pictures, and he actually just grabbed the source files and spun a new board based on that design. And it's actually grabbing some useful information from the CAN bus, like speed of the vehicle, the temperature of various fluids. And it's showing them on this head-up display that he put up on his dashboard.
That's cool. Yeah. So a lot of people that are like tweaking, and they like to,
typically
optimize their car and driving and stuff like that.
There might be other interesting stuff. There might be some secret stuff. I don't know. People are not telling me everything.
That's right. Yeah, it's not sending back telemetry from the ESP32 to Florin's computer. Like
that, so. Yeah.
No, that's great. I mean, and I think having that connectivity to then as well, I mean, you might even be able to put it, you know, under the hood through the firewall without having to actually punch through the firewall of a car. And you could have some more connectivity, which is great.
Yeah, you could adjust settings on the fly and just from a simple web page that you open up on your smartphone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean isolation then as well, right? If this thing's, I mean, not that it would be floating to high voltage levels or anything like that, but I guess maybe in a, if it was in a EV or something, it could maybe float up, right?
It's always nice that you, if you don't need to touch the hardware, once you've installed it, it's always nice if you don't need to get back in there and mess with the wiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, and so then interfacing with CAN as well, we've had Machina folks on here many years ago, and they were doing some CAN bus stuff. I remember them talking about, like, you just kind of like can kind of, it's not encrypted, you just kind of push and pull readings off of there. It seems like it's kind of the Wild West. You just have to like know what you're looking at and know what you're reading. Is that, does that sound right?
Yeah. So you do pick up everything that's on the bus, but knowing what every byte of data means, that's a whole nother story, because there is literally almost no standard. I mean, each manufacturer does have its own standards, but they're kind of secret about it, and they're not releasing it to the public. Got so it. You kind of do a lot of reverse engineering to figure out what's going on the bus and what each frame ID points to. Yeah. And sometimes manufacturer, they go on top of the standard CAN bus spec, and if they want to transmit more data, they wouldn't be able because of the CAN bus, you know, framing and how it's organized. But what they do is they sometimes split their data across multiple CAN transmissions, and they kind of add their own protocol on top of CAN bus to be able to reconstruct all of that data. And you're really in trouble if you're trying to decode something like that.
Yeah, you're like, this doesn't make any sense. You got to glue it back together. That's really weird. So like, in terms of like the CAN protocol and stuff like that then too, is it just if the bus is available, it's just like you can kind of take control, or their priority levels? How does that kind of all get coordinated?
So I'm hardly an expert on this field, but
more expert than I am. That's all that matters here.
Here's how it works. It's based on the so the way the CAN bus is designed is that it's based on the priority of the ID that you're sending. So So the lower the ID, the higher the priority, and that message is going to be processed first. Okay. And what happens in a typical automotive CAN bus network, like the most important stuff that's related to the engine, the braking, the critical stuff, that has the lowest IDs on the network.
So braking is only if you don't want to go fast, man. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it depends.
True racing mindset is, you know, braking is last.
I get that. Priorities can vary from one man to another.
Yeah. And is that like settable then as well?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Is that settable? Like, can you set what priority is what? Like, so if I open up the hood and started tinkering with the brake system, is there like a dip switch in there so I could switch priority from like a 6 to a 7?
No. So that's based on a fixed ID that particular module has that particular sensor has. So for example, I'm just pulling numbers here that might not be real addresses, but let's say some hex address, which is 110, has a higher priority than a higher number.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, I've done something like this on an RS45 bus where it was like lowest wins, because it was actually like, it was like XORing the addresses or something like that. But it was like going through all the different addresses, and basically once it hit the bit, once it hit like a one in a binary number, it's like, okay, now I know I can talk to this thing.
Yeah, so CAN bus is doing a similar thing, and I don't know all of the details, but if two devices want to talk at the same time, because of the way the network is constructed, the lower ID is always going to have priority. So he's going to talk first.
Got it. That sounds like kind of hectic.
and yet is used for the most important stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to start riding a bike more, I think.
I think there's really a lot of backup built into these protocols. So there are a lot of checksums and a lot of, you know, opposing values that need to match for the most important stuff for that computer to actually consider that information good and well received.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about it in terms of like if I was just grabbing modules off the shelf and like, you know, okay, this brake module, this engine module, whatever, and gluing it all together. But in reality, the car maker knows, they can decode all the packets. They know what's going on when they piece it all together.
Yeah.
And then we're just kind of reading it if we want to peek into their world, right?
Yeah, and to complicate things, typically on a car, you'll also find a CAN gateway, because on a car, there's usually more than one CAN networks. So all of these different CAN buses tie in to a CAN gateway, and the CAN gateway has to like interface between all of these buses and let through only some of the messages from one bus to another.
Got it. So it's like a translation system almost.
Yeah, almost. Like some of the messages from the engine we want to propagate down to the like the multimedia system, so we can show like RPM and speed on the digital screen. But we don't need to send all of the data from the engine CAN bus to the multimedia CAN bus. So all of this filtering happens.
Yeah. You don't need like the temperature of the cooling fluid or something like that, unless you're doing some really crazy stuff.
Yeah. And on top of that, to complicate things even more with more recent cars, they have also started encrypting some of the stuff. So like modules will first try to authenticate with the ECU to make sure that they belong to that car and they have not been like harvested from another car and just installed on this car. So they use some encrypted keys to authenticate, and only after authentication is successful, they start talking on the CAN bus.
I see.
So it's even more complicated with newer cars.
Huh. So then what are you, messing with your car? I mean, what's your interest in this?
Yeah. So what I wanted to do is, it turns out you can kind of display your own information on the small display you have inside your cluster with the speedo. And to do that, you basically have to first capture the information that you want shown there from the CAN bus. And then you'd have to send it in a certain way to the cluster computer, such as to create this custom menu on that small LCD and show your own data. So they have actually built in this functionality into the cluster firmware, because there are some modules on a car that would natively want to do this. I wanted to build this board to replicate this functionality and show data that wouldn't otherwise be visible on that small LCD screen.
I see. And you're monitoring, like, are you doing some mods and stuff like that to your car? Is that why?
I'm not a big fan of doing mods to my car, but it's just the electronic side, which is very interesting. And just reaching that milestone of finally being able to do that, it just means a lot to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I mean, and I guess we've implied here, but you are selling these as well. I mean, when you can source the components, you just made a video about having trouble sourcing, but what is the experience like selling Tindy and equivalent?
So the selling side of things on Tindy is pretty straightforward. Like they take care of everything, and that's pretty easy. I mean, I've only been on the platform for starting this year, so I don't have a lot of experience, but it's been going great for me. Now the actual building of the electronics during these times, that's a whole different story. So for example, I am already at revision D for the CAN light board, just because I need to constantly switch some parts and find new ones, because the old ones are not available anymore.
Yeah.
And they have those delivery dates of, I don't know, like next year or 2 years ahead. And I can't wait that long. And the people on my Tindy store can't wait that long.
That's right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's a shit show out there for sure. It's especially automotive, right?
I mean, especially, like that, yeah.
Yeah. More than anything else, you're just kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel.
It's probably the worst kind of business that you can be in at the hobby level that I am, right? It's worse for the big auto manufacturers, but if you think about it, it's going to be much worse for the little fish like myself.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that you offer the files. You're like, if you want to try and build this yourself, good luck.
Yeah. I've had the biggest trouble, finding the high side switches, but some people don't need those. They just want to hack their canvas and they just don't need to switch anything. So I have the option of ordering the board without those high side switches just in case I can't get them anymore.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah. That's it's crazy times. I mean, so do you have any tricks you'd like to share about sourcing components? Anything?
One trick which might be too late to apply for most people is to keep a good stash of the components that
right time machine that's called.
Yeah, so that saved me, like with a recent project that I was doing for a client on my consulting side of things. I just had a bunch of the parts that we needed for the prototypes that I was building for this client. I had them in my own stash of parts because I do have a lot of parts stashed in, you know, these IKEA plastic bins in my lab. And, you know, sometimes that really helps because I just went to my boxes and found the STN32s that he needed. I had about 10 of those left from a previous project. So I was able to build his 10 prototypes and everyone was happy.
I mean, what you really should have done is you should have sold those STM32s on the open market and just retired. You could have just been, you know, living large by the seashore.
Yeah, skip the hard work of building the hardware.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, how is it on the consulting side of things?
Well, it's hard. Like, I mean, recently I've had clients that are not necessarily building stuff in the, you know, hundreds of thousands or even thousands of pieces. So it's mostly they're building stuff in the tens of pieces. So
yeah,
in quantities. So that's much easier, but still you have some difficulties. Like you try to work your way around the design phase, such as to have some backup plan. Like is this IC really the only one that we could get it? Because if this becomes hard to get, then we're going to be unable to build these boards.
That's right. Yeah. You can have a bad time.
Yeah. So I try to do my best to, you know, find and select some components that have some that can be replaced at some point, maybe with a little effort, just by switching to a different footprint or adjusting some of the IO. But I try to keep in the back of my mind that I need to find a part that should and be able to be replaced at some point with a different part.
We're back with Mauser Electronics and talking with Paul Galata, Senior Technology Specialist, who will be talking about the new section on the Mauser Electronics resource page about immersive technology and how it will change workflows in the future. I asked Paul what he saw as the most impactful elements of immersive technology.
Well, I think there's a couple things. We're going to be doing designs in a whole new way. One of the exciting things, I think, from an engineer, what do we care about it, is collaboration is going to change immensely. You know, with the internet, we all communicate and share our ideas, but we do that kind of with pieces of paper, right? We've moved, as you've seen with all this COVID now, that everybody's doing Zoom and communicating on that, but it's still a kind of a two-dimensional thing. What, though, if I could step right now, instead of just seeing you on a screen and actually feel that you and I are present, that it feels like I'm just 3 feet away from you and you and I are having kind of a conversation where you can actually see me having my cup of coffee and you feel like that I'm present and it sounds that way and you can move around in a space with me and maybe we can jointly experience things together.
I asked Paul about some of the technologies that will allow us to feel more present across the web.
I think, first of all, it's interfaces that are providing new accessibility. So one of the ways, for example, is tactile connection. So you've probably seen people with gloves and the ability to take a type of glove that's on them, manipulate this glove, and then move digital objects in space. So that's coming. This whole explosion that's happened with spatial computing, leaders such as NVIDIA with what they're doing in the computational space and other world-class leading semiconductors are taking the ability to manipulate the math and the processing in three dimensions and do the calculations so that this whole three-dimensional aspect of what's going on and being able to both look around in a 360-degree world and go up, down, left, right, inside, outside in that that type of stuff. It's just happening automatically.
So what are some real-world examples of this experience, and how does it impact consumers?
My daughter and her husband are looking for a home. Well, you know what they're doing? They're virtually touring, all that type of stuff. Again, that's a virtual tour where you can look 360. They're doing it on a two-dimensional screen, but the next step is to be able to take that and, if you will, put on a headset, put on some, you know, tactile gloves, and you will be in the house. You won't just be looking at it two-dimensionally on a computer screen. You'll be like you're there, thereby making it so that it's almost like you went to the house itself. You can walk through and manipulate, you know, your space and position in this domain.
To learn more about immersive technology and how it might impact your workflow, check out the amphour.com/immersive, which will take you to the Mouser Electronics immersive technology page. And now back to the show. How are people finding you for your consulting work?
So I think my YouTube channel is the main gateway into finding clients for the consulting work. People will typically search online for a particular topic that they're interested in for building stuff. And sometimes they end up on my videos, where I might be talking about that subject. And they see, hey, this guy is talking about exactly what I want built.
Yeah, that's nice too, because then they come to you like, hey, can you build me a ESP32 with a CAN bus? It's like, oh, actually, yes, I can.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you have 33,000 YouTube subscribers, you know?
Yeah, something like
not,
that.
Not small, not huge, but definitely a good size. Seems like a good community. Would you recommend people start a YouTube channel just for kind of showcasing their services, or is it not really worth it just for that?
I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, it's a little more difficult these days to, you know, kind of get noticed on YouTube. There are, YouTube is so big these days, and it's a bit more difficult to get noticed. But YouTube, you know, from a search engine perspective, it's like, what, the second biggest search engine that people use. So that has to count for something. You know that at some point, people are going to be searching through YouTube stuff and they are going to be ending up on your videos.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's great. And I think especially if people are, you know, showcasing their own projects, right? If they want to like start consulting, I think it makes sense, or, you know, just start doing electronics for a living broadly, even if they're not consulting, maybe they want to go work for a company. It's like, if you're showcasing your own projects, you want to like show off what you've been working on, you're excited about electronics. It just seems like that's a good venue to do that sort of thing. It's just a lot of people are not wanting to be in front of the camera. Obviously, I think you're very natural in front of the camera, so that's a good start.
I mean, it's something that you work on. It's not going to be easy, or your first video is probably not going to be so great, but it's something that you work on and get better with over time. So that's not a reason not to start.
I think that's right. Yeah, it's you just gotta not care at the beginning.
And it's also good to not care along the way, because there's going to be some ugly comments that you receive.
Oh, well.
But it's part of the course, and you just have to move on.
That's great. I mean, over time as well, I'd imagine that you build out your lab. I mean, you do a lot of videos about your lab, you build out that sort of thing over time. It just kind of seems like a gradual build up.
Yeah. I mean, I've switched to like three different labs since I've started the YouTube channel in 2015. So you kind of build and improve with each new one. The latest one is the greatest, in my opinion. I have this great new workbench. Yeah. I did a video on the workbench build. I built it from aluminum profiles instead of the usual, you know, wood timber frame construction.
Yeah, I saw that. That was a good one. And you did like a, you were able to design, it was like an online design tool. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I did it in Fusion 360. I just built it how I imagined it. And then there are these online shops where you order your aluminum profiles already cut to size.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, that piece is what I was thinking about. Yep.
Yeah. And that's super helpful. I mean, if you can get those aluminum profiles cut to length, then the only thing that you have left to do is to assemble it with screws and nuts.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just staring at your cover image for this video. It's like you increase the size of your head or something. It's very like Uncanny Valley style. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that would be an interesting thumbnail.
Yeah, it looks like anime almost, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you have to get creative with these thumbnails. And yeah. I don't do it all the time, but when I do it, you notice it in...
You go in all the way.
Yeah, people just click that thumbnail more than they would otherwise.
Silly. Yeah. Yeah, that's the trade-off, I suppose, of the YouTube side of things.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, I mean, so on the consulting side and generally, like the stuff you're making videos about that you are interested in, like what would be, you know, what's your sweet spot, I suppose, on the consulting side? Is it STM32 kind of stuff? Is it ESP32? Is it automotive sensors? What are you hoping to do in general?
I haven't done any specific, you know, automotive stuff for my consulting side, because that's typically what, you know, companies that build stuff that actually goes into cars, they tend to deal with, you know, bigger consulting companies, not a one-man show like I'm running.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's one of the reasons which I haven't, you know, built any projects on that side of things professionally. But I do build a lot of IoT stuff on my consulting business. I have a lot of clients that would like to build, in general, you know, small stuff that's wirelessly connected and somehow contains some sensors, somehow transmits data over the air.
Yeah, that's great. I have said many times before, I think my paycheck for the next 10 years will be things that people want to hook to the internet, you know, like a lot of industrial things that they're just like, yeah, I just want, you know, I have this thing, I want it to work, or it already works, I want to make it work and talk to the internet. It's like, okay, well, that's not trivial, but we can make it do it.
I think that takes a good share of the market in this field, and kind of specifically, I think it tailors best to this type of business, this type of consulting business, where you would hire one or two engineers to work on that project and design it for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the scaling piece, especially, it depends who they come through with. I've had people come through as like software companies, and then they're like, yeah, we just need the hardware at the end piece. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then I've had other people who are like, I need you to do all of it. And then I have to usually pull in some software people and you know, that sort of thing. And then it's kind of a different style of thing, where it's almost like standing up an entire system for them versus kind of slotting into the system they already have.
Yeah, that can be nice. For example, I have my new lab in an office building, and there are some software coding guys here which are really good. And I did work with them on a past project with a client of mine, and it was a really good cooperation, you know, being so close with them. And I dealt with the hardware side of things. They did the software side of things for the client.
Yeah, that's great.
It's nice to have these kinds of people that you can collaborate with on such projects, because you deliver more value in the end to the customer.
Yeah, it's almost like you're building out like a little ad hoc team, and then kind of you scatter afterwards. It's good to have those kind of partnerships and stuff. Are you where are you mostly, like, in your area? Like, where are customers located? Are they kind of all over the place?
Most of the times, international customers.
Oh yeah, okay.
Like I have few customers from here, from Romania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But most of the times it's like United States, Germany, United Kingdom.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. International consultant of mystery.
I know, it's nice to meet all of these people. It's nice to work on such a variety of projects. Sometimes you get to work with other teams, because sometimes you're just brought on to help on a particular project on which an existing team is already working on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. can I try and convince you to go to Embedded World in March? Maybe we can meet up. I'm going to be there.
I was actually thinking about that because I've heard you mention that in a previous AmpHour.
Uh-huh.
So I was actually thinking about that.
Doesn't look like a short trip from your part of the world, but...
The last time I wanted to go to a similar meetup was to Hackaday Belgrade, I think. I even got plane tickets and booked some accommodation there, but you know, in the end it got canceled, so.
Oh, it was the 2021?
Yeah.
I've heard rumor that will come back, so that's good.
I'm kind of eager to you know, leave the country and go to one of these meetups.
Yeah, the same. Yeah, it's been a little too long since I've had like a true nerd out session, you know, in like in person, and it's just not the same on online, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a good chance I'll be there.
Okay, great. We'll coordinate after. We'll talk about that. But if other people are going too, then we could all meet up, you know, in a safe way, of course, you know, assuming that there's no flare-ups of COVID like usual. I long for the old days.
You know, we have to adapt.
Yeah. So you also are a ham. I was watching your video about the repeater you did about a month ago or so. What drove that interest?
So actually, I wanted to get my ham license even before COVID. And here in Romania, the exam, I mean, it's not super difficult, but it's not as easy as it is in other places. Like, you still have to pass this theory exam where they put you through all of these different subjects and kind of need to know them all to pass the exam. And I studied for the exam, then COVID came, then the exams got canceled delayed. And then I was reluctant to go to the next exam because of COVID. So it kind of took me 2 years until I got back on track and finally managed to go and take this exam for the ham operator license.
Nice.
And I got it. My call sign is Yankee Oscar 4 Victor Lima Tango. That is in call sign language. I'm happily using that language, even though it's not necessary.
You said Yankee Oscar 4 Lima Tango, is that right?
Victor Lima Tango. It's Victor. Like an abbreviation from Voldog.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm probably too excited for this.
That's great. Oh, cool. Well, and how far afield is it taking you? Are you making contacts far and wide?
No. No. For once, because of lack of gear, and I'm probably also not really into that thing, making no long range contacts. I know it's a thing in the ham operator world, but it's not what attracts me. I just have a small Baofeng radio and I just use it to connect to one of these repeater networks that the awesome guys here in Romania built. It's called Rolling. And so what they did is they built this network of repeaters. So you can connect locally, short range, to one of these repeaters over analog, and then it just goes through the internet into this national network.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting in like the days of like the internet too. You know, obviously, you and I are talking over very, very large distances, and you know, we're near perfect quality.
Yeah.
But there's still something about it of like, you know, doing that through a handheld. Basically, you know, you have, you know, just it's for the interest of doing the ham radio side of things. So
yeah. So as you were saying, I built one of these smaller repeaters myself because, for once, you can connect to one of these, you know, let's call them higher power repeaters that some people build and maintain. But at some point, that repeater is probably going to be offline, or you're probably going to be going off coverage. And I built this portable repeater unit that just uses a small single board computer and Orange Pi.
Yep.
And it uses one of these walkie-talkie modules. I believe the part number is SA818. So it's a module the size of an ESP32 module that basically has all of the walkie-talkie functionality built into it.
Yeah. Like, yeah, TXRX, it does the keying for you, yeah. All that kind of thing, right? It's just like simple GPIO inputs and a single antenna.
Yeah, and half a watt or up to 1 watt of output power. Yeah. So you have this portable node that you can connect to like a wireless hotspot that you generate from your smartphone, and it goes through the internet, and you're onto the network from like any place where you get cell coverage.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I mean, like that is really fun for like, you know, if you're doing events or similar kind of things. It's just
definitely
it's a lot of fun,
and it can hold more users, like not just for yourself.
True. That's true. That's true. Huh? Yeah, I just finished the Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, and there's an anecdote in there where he's in Brazil and he's trying to get data from Caltech. He was on sabbatical in Brazil, and he was using these long range contacts to contact Caltech, you know, like Pasadena, California. And it's like, oh, that sounds terrible. Like that's when it was really, really important that you had that sort of thing. But now it's just like, okay, well, send an email or
nobody thinks about it anymore. Yeah.
Exactly.
Distance is not a problem anymore.
Yeah. But now it's just for fun. And I mean, that's a super cool module. So then in terms of like the interfacing, was it tough to actually getting that walkie talkie module to talk to the Pi?
No, because I have this kind of mindset when I'm building these projects, and this is partly due to the fact that I present them on YouTube and I do a video each week. So I kind of don't have a lot of time at my disposal to build these projects and document them and present them on a YouTube video. So usually that's not enough time to build both hardware and software. That's usually just enough to build hardware and maybe just a little bit of software.
Got it. Yeah.
Just the time frame is too short. And what I like to do is I try to build projects where I can do a lot of the hardware side and very little of the software side. And this is one of those examples where the software side of things was already done for me.
Yeah. Because of it's on the Pi and there's like a software stack on that Linux board and stuff.
Yeah. They just built this Linux image that you just load onto an SD card. And it already has all of the required scripts and software pre-installed. It's just a small config file that you need to adjust to your own needs, and then you're up and running.
Hmm. Yeah. Florin, when are we going to want to get better at software? This is the thing I keep struggling with, you know? I don't know, you know?
I don't think there's enough pressure these days. I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, maybe there was a lot more pressure and you really had to do it yourself. But these days, I take on a new project, and even if it needs a large chunk of software to be written with, I can just collaborate with a programming guy that does all the programming for me. I deal with the hardware, he deals with the software, and we're both happy at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. See, now this is another thing where the internet, it just ruined things, you know, it ruined the long range contacts, it ruined the collaboration, it used to be more self-sufficient, I guess, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah.
We just get to play around with the stuff that we really like, the hardware, you know.
Yeah, I have a lot of examples like this in my recent projects. The other one is the valve controller based on ESP32.
Mm-hmm.
That one just was designed to run this open source firmware, which is called Tasmota, and it's this MQTT-based platform that runs on ESP8266 and on ESP32s, and it's just great for building automation-type stuff because it has drivers for most of the stuff that you would normally connect to an ESP32, and you just load that firmware image and you're good to go. You just need to configure some GPIO and everything just runs.
Huh. And what kind of valves are we talking about here?
I'm talking about these thermostat valves for a floor heating system.
Oh, cool. Okay. Like a radiative, like a style heating?
Yeah, they are electric valves. They are typically based on this wax cartridge, and they have this small resistive heater. So when you apply power, it starts heating up, and you know, it takes about 2 minutes for the wax inside that cartridge to completely expand and push this pin to actuate the valve.
Huh. It's wax based? That's really weird.
I don't quote me on that. It's probably not the most accurate piece of information. I'm just guessing here, because other types of similar valves are built on wax cartridges.
Well, that's really cool if it is, though. I mean, like, I just feel like that would wear out, but I guess
it turns out it's the most reliable way of controlling these valves, because the other way would be to have some mechanical, you know, gears and that's a lot more parts that have to move, and that's a lot more stuff that could fail in the long term.
Yeah, right. And I was worried about that sort of, and so this is like resistive heating, or is this like the
resistive
fluid style?
It's just a resistive component in there that heats up something, could be wax, could be another type of fluid that just expands with temperature inside the cartridge. And through the action of that fluid expanding, it just pushes a pin that actuates a thermostat valve.
That's super cool. Yeah. And so this is what's keeping your lab warm, or your home, or what do you use it for?
Yeah, I use it in my home because I recently installed one of these floor heating systems. And you don't really need this level of automation, but if you're like an electronics engineer, why wouldn't you do it?
I mean, what do we really need, though, in our lives in that way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can go without it, but it's fun to build.
Totally.
And you can then get statistics, and what engineer doesn't love seeing nice statistics and graphs in his home automation project?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I always think they also have those kind where they have like liquid going through piping in the floor. That's what I thought it was at first. Talking about.
Yeah, it's based on liquid. There are pipes laying in the floor.
Oh, what is that? Okay. All right.
Yep.
I thought it was resistive, like a wire in the floor, like a heating element.
There's actually liquid going into those pipes.
Uh-huh.
And because you have different circuits going to different rooms or different sides of the room, you want to be able to control those circuits individually. So you have one of these valves on each of the circuits so that you could turn it on or off based on the heat requirements for that specific room.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I always wanted something like that. I always just felt like that idea of like having like a nice toasty warm floor would be like super nice, and like to be able to dial it in so that when you're not in a room, it turns off, whatever. And my answer instead was to move south.
Yeah, I heard about that in your recent Ampar talks, that you move south and the winter is much nicer now. You go out for walks.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. It was 70 the other day. It was 22C the other day. It was great. It was, I'm quite wimpy now though. I get cold much easier, so that's the downside. I'll be traveling to see family for the Thanksgiving holiday here, and I'm a little worried about how I'll handle it.
Probably gonna have to pack some warm clothes.
That's right. Yeah. Does this floor heater, does it work for like heating clothing?
No, but I do think they sell something that works off a power bank or something like
they
that.
Do. Yeah, they do. I saw they actually have it at like the home repair store here. They sell them there, and I had heard about it like on Banggood as well. You could get like resistive heating elements for your clothing.
But I think you've lived in the cold side for a lot of years, so there should be something left in you.
You'd think. Yeah, I hope so. Well, I'll find out soon. By the time this episode is published, I'm sure I'll have some feedback.
Well, I am the kind of person that much prefers the cold over the warm.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm talking about the extremes here. I would rather stay in extreme cold than extreme hot weather.
Huh? What are the ranges of temperatures in your part of the world?
It depends. I mean, especially in the last few years, we've had some change of things in what the weather is like, and I think anyone all over the world can say the same thing. It's not the same as it used to be.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
But typically in the winter, right, in December to January, right here where I live, we can get -10 degrees in the night. Celsius.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it can go, you know, positive 5 degrees over the day if it's nice and sunny. Mm-hmm. But during the summers, if it's a very hot summer, we can easily get 35 degrees Celsius, even higher than that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's pretty big swings.
Yeah.
But I mean, you are right near the water too, so that helps.
That helps. Yeah, definitely helps.
I mean, if nothing else, then to just be able to run and jump in the water, you know?
Yeah, that definitely helps.
Yeah, that's great. So we are approaching the end of the show, but also approaching the holidays. I wanted to point out you have a really fun video about gifts for electrical engineers. I thought that's, you do a lot of mailbag stuff, but I think mm-hmm. this is really useful for people that are looking to, you know, tell their family what to get them for the holidays. You know,
I mean, I look at my family members and they really struggle when they're trying mm-hmm. to get me a present.
Yeah. Like, what? You want what? For what?
Yeah. Yeah. And they kind of, they've gotten used to it and they kind of feel the stress when the holidays come up because they really need to find something that's going to be appreciated, and they go through the stress. And I was thinking, hey, there must be other people out there going through the same trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like great. Doing these videos every year. And I typically like showing stuff that I have owned and have tested in these videos. That's always a positive thing when I can say about a particular tool that I have used it for the past year or even more, and I find it useful.
Yeah. So can we get, out of the 10 that are in this list, can we get maybe a preview of two of them so that people can hear some ideas, price range and what they are?
Yep. I'll give you a very cheap one that I think it's really useful and every electronics engineer that builds prototypes and tinkers with electronics should have. And that is the aluminum syringe plunger. So, you know, as when you typically order these flux or solder paste syringes, they tend to come either without a plunger or with a very skinny plastic one.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this aluminum designed one that fits over a standard solder paste or flux syringe. And so it's reusable. When that syringe is done, you can just install it on the next syringe. And it just, it just feels good when you're dispensing solder paste or flux from a syringe to use one of these. They're sometimes called boosters on AliExpress, and they're mm-hmm. really cheap. They're like, $4 or $5 a piece.
And is it just because it doesn't push any harder, right? But I guess it won't snap if you push really hard, but
yeah, it just feels like something solid as opposed to a flimsy plastic plunger that you take from a standard syringe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good one. I like that.
And on the more expensive side of things, I can talk about the Unity waveform generator, which I got this year.
Is that the one that you said everybody should have, must have this one?
Yeah, it's that one. Because I believe it's just over $100 or something like that shipped.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's a really cool waveform generator. I mean, if you're an advanced user, it's probably not for you. Mm-hmm. But if you're just starting out with electronics, or if you want to run your own experiments, or if you don't need anything high frequency or very, very clean signal, I think it can work just great for you, for experimenting, just for educational purposes. I think it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like, looks like it's like a tiny bench instrument, just looking at the size of the ports stuff.
Very small and compact. It's powered by a USB line. So you could very easily turn it into a portable unit. You can power it from a power bank just as easily.
Yeah. And do you think this has benefits over, I guess this is a bench instrument, over like a USB based instrument? I was talking about the Analog Discovery 2 last episode, and it seems like it's about the same range and stuff. I'm guessing the chipset's probably pretty similar.
I haven't used the Analog Discovery. I know about its functionality. I don't know about its specs or cost, but if it's in the same price range, then it probably depends on how your preferred way of working is.
No, it's like almost double or triple. So,
But it also adds a lot more functionality, I would guess.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is good. This is a good bench one for sure. It's very cute and compact. I mean, it definitely like has the right form factor that's pretty fun. So
I mean, some people prefer to work standalone on with workbench mm-hmm. type instruments. Some people yeah. prefer to work in front of a computer. So it also depends on how you prefer to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, a lot of people are, they just say, no, I need to have a screen. I need to have knobs I could turn, buttons I can push, that sort of thing. So I think this is a nice interface for that sort of thing.
Yeah, so these would be like my cheap and a bit more expensive selection from that video that I would recommend as gifts for
yeah.
engineers for holiday season.
Yeah, and I think too is like if you're going to get stuff off, like so like the waveform generators off Banggood, and it's like you got to probably get the order in now to get it in time for the holidays
oh, yeah.
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I've been hearing that it's especially difficult this year with the, you know, the whole postal and logistics systems worldwide. Mm-hmm. We're going yeah. through some tough times.
Yeah. Yes. Buy your gifts early, folks, or else you're going to have to shop in person. Good Lord. Oh, man. Well, Florin, I would highly recommend people check the rest of your videos out. I enjoy every single one of them. You are a must-watch channel on my YouTube subscription, so please keep making great videos. I really like the stuff you're making.
Thank you so much, Chris. It means a lot to hear it from you because you talk to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I do talk to a lot of people, but you know, this is you're making the kind of content I like, including KiteCat videos. So keep that yeah. up too.
Yeah.
Where can people find you online generally?
So people can find me on youtube.com/voldog. I mainly publish YouTube videos once a week, but I'm also mm-hmm. on twitter.com/voldog. I tweet once in a while.
Great. And you have a Tindy store as well.
I also have a Tindy store. Just search for voldog on tindy.com and you'll find some of the products showcased on my YouTube videos. Some of them can be purchased from my Tindy store.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me today, Florin. I really enjoyed talking to you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. Thank you for having me on the show.